Before I was old enough to go out on New Year's Eve, the best part of the New Year was listening to my favorite disc jockeys count down the top 100 records of the year. Well, that's not exactly what we're going to do today on Fresh Air, but we are about to hear some of the best records of the year, as chosen by Fresh Air's rock critic Ken Tucker. And he's going to tell us about some of rock's new directions and dead ends in 1988. And yes, he will present his top 10 list, and will even give you an address if you'd like to send for copies. Ken writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He formerly was the pop music critic for the Inquirer and for the Los Angeles Herald Examiner. Happy New Year, Ken.
Oh, same to you.
Thanks. Is there any performer or trend that you think really defines 1988?
Well, if you believe trade magazines like Billboard, they'll tell you that this is the year of George Michael, which I think if it were really true, I would have to contemplate suicide. it's one of those situations where the man sells 20 million albums, gets number one singles. And I think it's a clear example, one of the purest imaginable, of the way sales figures don't measure cultural impact in pop music anymore. I think that, more broadly speaking, there was no single event or record or star around which 1988 pop kind of organized itself in a way that in previous years when you would have, say, Michael Jackson's Thriller, that was a cultural event, whereas 1988, Michael Jackson releases Bad, and that album is not a cultural event. It's a collection of songs. There was no Live Aid this year as the way there were in years past, a kind of concert that takes over the media attention, even though there was something like the Human Rights Now Amnesty International tour. Whether or not that's just because people got tired of hearing about those big tours or it doesn't capture their imagination or not, I just think that it was a much more scattered and therefore, I think, in a lot of ways, interesting season in popular music.
So should we look at some trends that didn't amount to much?
Sure. I mean, I think that something like the rise of Tracy Chapman was significant in the sense that here was a black woman folk singer getting a number one record, selling, I think, was at least 2 million copies, a fairly unprecedented event. And yet at the same time, I found that record to be not quite as revolutionary as it, I think, would like to have presented itself. I think that in a lot of ways that the truly revolutionary record of the year was Public Enemy's It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, which was a rap album. And the reason I bring that up is that I think that when you hear something like Tracy Chapman's song talking about a revolution, I think she never does explain what she means by a revolution, which I think was one way that a large mass audience could buy that album without having it disturb them greatly. And I think that if Tracy Chapman really wanted to say what the terms of revolution were, she would have to use language and ideas that Public Enemy did do in their record.
We'll hear Public Enemy later.
Sure.
But let's hear Tracy Chapman now.
Good.
Don't you know we're talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper? Don't you know we're talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper? While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. Poor people gonna rise up and get their share. Poor people gonna rise up and take what's theirs.
That's Tracy Chapman. Ken, I was really surprised at how much airplay this got, at how well the record sold. I thought it was going to be on college stations, and I'm not sure what explains the sudden commercial success of the type of record that was usually confined to alternative stations.
Yeah, I don't know precisely what either, but I certainly think that her image really captured people. Then in a certain way, you were buying an image as much as you were buying a record. I mean, I certainly don't deny her talent. I think she does have strengths as both a songwriter and as a singer. Yet at the same time, I think that there's something limiting about that. I was reading an essay by that great rock critic Walter Benjamin, written in 1934. He was talking about literature, but I think that there's a phrase that he used that was exactly appropriate to Tracy Chapman's record, which is that he says that the struggle against misery is turned into an object of consumption. And I think that that's exactly what happens. These kinds of protest songs are so smoothly developed that that it just becomes another record, another pop record to enjoy as a hit.
Rock critic Ken Tucker is with us, and we're looking at the year of 1988 in rock music. Let's move on to hard rock.
Yeah, this was a very big year for hard rock commercially. You had the presence of bands like Guns N' Roses and Def Leppard kind of constantly throughout the year in the top 10, which was significant in the sense that they're both fairly young acts, especially Guns N' Roses, an L.A. hard rock band. And they shared time on the charts with music that was completely the opposite. The Tracy Chapman record, a lot of movie soundtracks like The Dirty Dancing, lots of oldies. And so this was kind of a resurgence of that kind of youthful music. And I think that the Guns N' Roses album, in fact, was probably indeed the best commercial mainstream pop hard rock album released this year. I think it kind of deserved its popularity in that sense. I think as has come out in kind of interviews and their public presentation, they themselves are sort of jerks, but they're very talented jerks. But I also think that you have also the rise of a band like Metallica, which also has an album in the top 10. A year ago, Metallica was considered a speed metal band, an offshoot of punk rock, a very obscure band, and suddenly finds itself very much a mainstream taste. And I think in that sense, what I found to be the most exciting, loud, abrasive music was by a New York band called Sonic Youth. And they put an album out called Daydream Nation, a double record set. That's by far their most accessible record, and I think in many ways their best record. And I think that if in this year Metallica and Guns N' Roses could crack the top 10, it would seem to me that Sonic Youth's record, which was just fairly recently released, and going into 1989 could easily become just as accessible.
Let's play something by Sonic Youth.
Good. This is a song called Total Trash.
It started the top. Now it's spiraling down. What's best when it's lost? Digging under the ground. Never mind it now. We can bring it back. It's total trash. And it's a natural fact that I'm not no cow. It's never the same.
You know what I find interesting about this? This is actually the first time I'm hearing Sonic Youth after reading about them for a while. But their voices are really very controlled.
Yeah, well, I think in that record in particular, this new one, they've brought the voices forward more, and you can hear them more, and they're interesting voices. I mean, I think you can pick up influences. You can hear that sort of Lou Reed, Velvet Underground sort of influence. But at the same time, it's very original, I think, the way they're combining that real raw, feedbacky guitar with those kinds of vocals.
This was a year where there were several interesting comebacks.
There were many, many comebacks, many attempted comebacks, many failed comebacks. People like Patti Smith and Boz Scaggs and Hall & Oates, Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin, all making these records that just failed dismally in the marketplace. I think that Pat Benatar made a sort of comeback after a couple of years that was should have been recognized as a hit. Same with Joni Mitchell. These things didn't do too well. I think the music industry is beginning to realize that if you take that long an absence from the scene, there is indeed a good chance you'll be forgotten. But I thought one of the most interesting comebacks and commercial failures was by Brian Wilson, who put out his first solo album, apart from the Beach Boys work that he's done. And I thought it was a wonderful record. It didn't do very well at all. And the irony I thought there was that the Beach Boys, without Brian Wilson, scored their first number one single in more than a decade with a song called Kokomo from the movie Cocktail. A lot of people are kind of using this as a kind of yin and yang. It's like, oh, those awful, hideous Beach Boys. I actually thought Kokomo was pretty good. I think you have to be able to listen to it and get past the fact that arch conservative jerk Mike Love is singing the lead, but I think it's a thoroughly respectable Beach Boys song. But I do think that the Brian Wilson record is much more interesting and inventive and witty.
And for people who don't know them, we should mention that Brian Wilson used to be the main songwriter and lead singer
producer
of the Beach Boys.
Yeah, I mean, he's really responsible for the Beach Boys sound.
Should we play something from his comeback record?
Yeah, it was a really terrific song that was released as a single and flopped called Walkin' the Line.
That's Brian Wilson, and all the voices on there.
That's
Brian
right.
Wilson.
Yeah, it's all Brian Wilson overdubbed. I mean, I think it's a great story about him. I mean, in a sense, I think it suffered from the publicity campaign around that record, which was primarily directed toward Brian Wilson's physical and psychic rehabilitation after a breakdown he had had, and his work with Dr. Eugene Landy, the therapist that he worked with, and Landy gets credit on the lyrics and things like that. And there was a lot of controversy about that, and I think it obscured what was a really nice, bright pop record.
Any other comebacks you want to note?
Yeah, I think that Randy Newman had not made an album in 5 years. 5 years is pretty much of a generation in pop terms, and I think that his album, Land of Dreams, initially I reviewed it for Fresh Air and had lots of reservations about it. I felt that it was kind of too much of a throwback to his earlier work in the way the same themes seemed to be explored. But the more I listen to it, I must say, it's really one of those things where a second, third, fifth, 10th, 20th listen has yielded a lot more on it. And I really like the record a lot. I like the way the music is arranged. I think there's really some beautiful melodies on it, quite aside from whatever you may think of whether or not the jokes in it are cheap or not. And I really like, in particular, one of the toughest songs on it, one called Roll with the Punches.
Why don't we give it a listen?
Children living in a burned up room, one bare light bulb swinging. Little black kid come home from school, put his key in the door. Mr. Rat's on the stairway, Mr. Junk is lying his own vomit on the floor. You got to roll with the punches, little black boy. That's what you got to do. You got to roll with the punches. All these boring people see them on TV making up all these boring stories about how bad.
I love the kind of vaudevillian piano that he's playing.
Yeah, right? Combined with that faintly ominous vocal. I think it's really neat.
That's Randy Newman's latest album. And why don't we take a look at what's happening in black pop in the year of 1988?
Yeah, I thought there were a lot of really strong black pop singles. I think there are a lot of black acts in a way that had been denied to them in the past few years, had much more access to radio stations, and really there were a lot more crossover singles. I thought the biggest success story in that area was DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, which had a huge hit with Parents Just Don't Understand. I think that there were new acts like Bobby Brown, who had a terrific song called My Prerogative. Bobby Brown used to be in First Edition. There's a new group called The Boys that Motown Records has. It's really the first kid act since the Jackson 5 that has really come up with something very strong. I think this song, Dial My Heart, which is a big hit single right now, even as we speak, is it's like a real raw early Jackson 5 kind of song.
Let's hear it. A group called The Boys.
That's right. I should have said that when I was talking about Bobby Brown, I meant New Edition, not First Edition. That's newspaper kind of talk, I guess.
And my guest is Ken Tucker, who writes for a newspaper, the Philadelphia Inquirer, where he, as the television critic, writes about popular culture. He was formerly the rock music critic there, also former rock music critic at the Los Angeles Herald Examiner, and of course, rock critic for Fresh Air. And what we're doing is reviewing the year of 1988 in rock music, and we'll have more of some of the best records of 1988 after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Rock critic Ken Tucker is my guest, and we're reviewing some of the best records of 1988. Ken, most of the records you've played, you've played because they indicated certain new directions, or that they were especially good in their genre of rock.
Right.
But the next records we're going to hear are actually on your 10 best list. You thought these were some of the best of 1988.
Yeah, as far as my own favorites, records like Womack and Womack's Conscious, I thought was a wonderful record, and I thought Public Enemy had made by far the strongest rap record and in many ways the strongest pop album of the year. It's an album called It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. It was put out by Def Jam Records, a rap label, but I think that one of the reasons I love it and I'm fascinated by it and play it over and over again is the way it combines so many different kinds of music. I mean, I hear that kind of harmelotic Ornette Coleman jazz in it. I hear rap music. I hear Sly Stone, James Brown. There's all sorts of influences working there. A lot of people are kind of leery. I notice a lot of people talk to me about this record and say, yeah, I like the sound of it, but what they're saying is, you know, it's all this kind of militant Louis Farrakhan kind of stuff. And I think that given the context in which this record exists, that it's a real interesting statement. I don't find it offensive, racist at all. I find that in the context in which it exists in an essentially racist music industry, it's a very, very strong statement.
What would you like to play from it?
I'd like to play a song called Don't Believe the Hype.
Now here's what I want you all to do for me.
Don't believe it. Don't believe the hype. Don't believe it. Don't believe the hype.
I got flavor in all those things, you know.
Yeah, boy, part two bum rush the show. Yo, Grip.
Get the green, black, and red in. Gold down, countdown to Armageddon. 8828, the S1s will put the left in effect, and I still will rock the hard jams, treat it like a seminar. Reach the bourgeois and rock the boulevard. Some say I'm negative, but then I'm positive. What I got to give?
The media says this.
Red,
yo,
black,
don't
and green.
That hype. They got to be,
you know what
that
I mean?
You know what I'm saying? Yo, the megas got them going up to see Captain Kirk like a jerk, and they out of work. Let me tell you a little something, man. A lot of people on daytime radio scared of us because they too ignorant to understand the lyrics of the truth that we pumping into them clouds, that brain cells, that's fun under them wooden skulls they call caps, you know what I'm saying? But the S1s are straightening it out quick, fast, in a hurry. Don't worry, flavor vision ain't blurry, you know what I'm saying? Don't terminate it. Don't believe the hype.
Can't you think that this record is evidence that, that rap hasn't dead-ended?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think this is one of those records that either gives you a headache or you lock into so completely that you're totally in on its wavelength. And I think that's, to a certain extent, it's not a huge hit. I mean, relatively speaking, it's gone gold, which means it's sold over 500,000 copies. But I think that it's one of those records that much more than, say, what George Michael has done actually has an effect. I mean, people now have to, in rap, in other forms of music, confront what Public Enemy have done and go on from there because they've, I think, kind of set a new standard for what that music is.
You surprised at how well rap has endured? I mean, did you expect it to be a novelty that would be gone the year after it started?
I did, sort of. But at the same time, it was always clear to me that rap was such a logical extension from what had been happening with James Brown, Sly Stone. I very much saw it as George Clinton's funk music in the 70s. I really saw a certain line of influence there that if it could have been sustained, and I think it has now for 10 full years, and they still don't play it on MTV regularly, that it could last forever.
Let's get to one other record from your top 10 list.
Yeah, the other record that I really like a great deal is Womack and Womack's Conscience. This was their third album. Womack and Womack are Linda and Cecil Womack, a husband and wife team. Linda is Sam Cooke's daughter. Cecil is the brother of Bobby Womack, who had a lot of hits, songwriting hits, about 10 years ago. And I just think it's a wonderful record of a completely different nature about marriage and commitment and family life and the importance of all those things, things that lots of people think aren't in rock and roll and certainly are evident here.
Let's hear it. That's Womack and Womack. The song is Conscious of My Conscience. One of the things I really enjoy about their records is that, they're both great singers, and you can really hear them singing. I think one of the things that's happened to a lot of black pop music is something that happened even long before in a lot of white pop music, and that is it really kind of became a producer's art in a way, and that the voices were almost so processed that a lot of the voices have become anonymous. It's mm-hmm. sometimes hard to tell one from another because they're so processed and so in the background in the mix.
Yeah, I think that Womack and Womack are so confident in their abilities as singers that they're not afraid to let that kind of raw edge to their voices show, and in fact, they strive for that because I think that obviously, I think it conveys a lot more emotion, and they can get a lot more emotional range by singing the way they do. There's a lot more. What I really like about it is the way the whole album is this conversation between the two of them. They alternate songs, talking to each other. One song that she's written addresses a song that he's written and answers it. It's real interesting that way.
Well, I have a fabulous offer to announce, and that is Ken Tucker's top 10 list is being made available. If you would like a copy of his top 10 list, which he's about to read, you can just send us a self-addressed stamped envelope to Fresh Air, WHYY, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. I'll give that address again after we hear the top 10. And just to explain, a lot of the records that we've heard today aren't necessarily on the top 10 list. Some of them were just indicative of interesting new trends in 1988 or were just very good records. But Ken, why don't you read your actual top 11 or...
top 11, top 10.
Yeah.
Yeah, these are in no particular order, I think, once we get past the first couple, but they're all, I think, really strong records. The Public Enemy record, It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. The Womack and Womack record, Conscience. And then Prince, Love Sexy. The Was Not Was record, What Up Dog is the name of it. Brian Wilson's album, which is just called Brian Wilson. Randy Newman's record, Land of Dreams. Rodney Crowell, I thought, made the strongest country album of the year, called Diamonds and Dust. Till Tuesday's album, Everything's Different Now. Grievously overlooked album, Nick Lowe's Pinker and Prouder Than Previous, which I just like to say the title anyway. What else? Joni Mitchell, Chalk Mark and a Rainstorm, another comeback that failed that was a great record. And I really liked The Traveling Wilburys, Volume 1.
So that's Ken Tucker's top, I think it's 11,
yeah,
of 1988.
Yes, I think so.
And if you'd like a copy, you can write to us. Just send us a self-addressed stamped envelope, and we'll send you a copy, and at no extra charge, we'll give you his top singles of the year as well. So the address is Fresh Air, WHYY, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. Well, Ken, I want to wish you a very happy new year.
Well, same to you.
And I thank you very much for sharing some of the best records of the year with us.
Thanks, well, thanks.
For being
it was
here.
Fun.
My guest has been Fresh Air's rock critic, Ken Tucker, who writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.